Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Jacobite Clans. In this episode we're going to be talking about legacy aspects of the Jacobite Clans exhibition, looking beyond Culloden, Tartan and the royal visit of 1822. For those of you that don't know, the exhibition features some of the great Perthshire clans and families, and we've invited our younger visitors to the exhibition and asked them to create their own crests, their own mottos and design their own clan insignias. One aspect that's aroused a lot of interest is Tartan. So Nikki, what have been the key talking points around this?
Well, the exhibition, as you say, features all the big Perthshire clans. Of course, these days, the clans can all identify their own particular tartans. We also have fragments of tartan on display. And there's a wonderful painting of a young girl wearing tartan and carrying the symbolic white rose, which has also caught people's imagination. We were also really lucky to meet and work with people from Clanranald Trust for Scotland. These guys teach living history. They have a fort and they regularly feature as various characters in lots of historical films, including Outlander.
You just said they had a fort, as in their own fort.
Yeah. The Clanranald Trust is constructing a full-scale replica of an early medieval fortified village. Get that right. It's typical of the Scottish clan chief's residence throughout the earlier part of the last millennium, and it's in the Carron Valley Forest. You can check out their website, clanranald.org, but it is an amazing place. We actually visited. A couple of us went on to see what they had, and they came along to the exhibition to give us a full-scale replica costume. We're looking at the shirt and the kilt and the waistcoat, jackets, weapons, so on. And our Outlander figure, as we call him, he's on display alongside other depictions of Highland dress.
It's great, and it is the costumes that these guys wear is pretty much how the costumes are depicted in the series. And these guys, the Clanranald folk, they are reenactors then. They recreate the past, yeah?
Yeah, pretty much. They cover a really wide time period and they've done lots of film work. And we also had reenactors here for the exhibition in the summer. They were a French group, a different group called Sir Alba. You can find them on Facebook if people are interested. But they came to visit us at the exhibition and they did a sort of outdoor event with us in the plaza outside. And they also spent a weekend at Killiecrankie. These groups are recreating the past and they are really experiencing history. So it's vital that they do huge amounts of research into weaponry, costume, lifestyle, even things like the food and medicine of the period, how people dressed, how they prepared food, and how they made all the kinds of things that they used are all recreated and really with incredible attention to detail. Some of these groups feature at Killiecrankie every year for the anniversary of the battle. This is the 330th one, so it's a special year. And they've made some really good friends locally, which is really community spirited, really nice. If you find them on Facebook or follow the soldiers of Killiecrankie on any social media, you'll find their short films, which show you what happens at all of these events, which is really interesting as well. So and people you can get involved, you really can.
Mm-hmm. And Nikki, you said that Outlander's up there with other depictions of Highland dress, and I guess this is something that's kind of really kind of changed over time. Or are the tartans and the clothes that you see today, do they really date that far back?
Well, one thing we do know is that there's no doubt that a number of different tartans have existed in Scotland for centuries and that these were loosely associated with different areas. We know this because this was being regularly recorded by travellers in Scotland in the 16th century, for instance. There is evidence of much earlier tartan-checked style of cloth being found, but it's just not clear how that develops into what we think of as tartan in the 16th century. By that time, the use of wool as the yarn for weaving tartan was established, and this would have been spun on spinning wheels, and natural things would have been used for dyes to give the traditional old colours, and then it would have been woven by hand to make the different tartans or patterns, at least, of that time.
Yeah, and then tartan, it is quite old, but how do we get to what we see today? I mean, there's a formal Highland dress for occasions like dinners, weddings, conferences. People just wear kilts any way they like.
Sure.
And then, like, you know, for example, like people go to the rugby, they're always in tartan kilts, you know, Scots abroad for football, things like that. And it is quite tribal as well. Kind of just like the clans, really, and we do like to know like what tartan is ours and kind of wear it proudly. We do,
and I mean the tartan is a great thing, but the big date for tartan, it appears to me, is really what happens around Culloden. Tartan was worn by both armies. But the Highlanders were in a whole variety of designs, but I don't believe that at that time these could really be identified as clan or families, maybe, but only in a really loose way. Following the defeat at Culloden, one of the ways devised to really crush the rebellions was a ban on tartan. And this is where things can be a wee bit muddled, but the ban was imposed by an Act of Parliament in 1746, an act for the more effectual disarming of the Highlands in Scotland and for more effectual securing of peace of the said Highlands and for restraining the use of the Highland dress. So that's a kind of title, if you like. Under this Parliamentary Act, men and boys were forbidden to wear or put on Highland clothes, including the kilt, plaid. No tartan or plaid or stuff was to be used for great coats or for upper coats. Now, this didn't actually apply to those men serving in soldiers in Highland regiments or to gentry, the sons of gentry, or to women. So sometimes people say, oh, they banned tartan after Culloden. Well, it's a wee bit trickier than that. They didn't quite ban it. It wasn't outlawed, but some people could wear it. But a lot of people couldn't wear it in the way that they had. But this ban lasted for 36 years. So it's quite a long time, really, for these things to be in place. And we also have to remember that the ban only affected, and I'll quote this again, that part of North Britain called Scotland. We've got North Britain here, so I really like that from the period. And the area was roughly defined as meaning the Highlands. The lowlands of Scotland were not seen to be nearly as wild, untamed, or as rebellious as the Highlands. So we have a bit of a divide going on in Scotland going on there too. So it's important to keep that in mind.
And is that important when we're thinking about tartan as well?
Well, apparently, according to historians of tartan, yes, it is. I have met, and we were contacted by a chap called Peter MacDonald. He's a great website. Again, you can look that up, Peter MacDonald, tartan historian. And he covers all kinds of tartan in history and research. And his research certainly suggests that we know a great deal of modern ideas about tartan because of a firm which started up near Stirling. Now, this is south of that north-south sort of divide that we're talking about. And it was unaffected by the ban on tartan, and the firm was started by a man called William Wilson. This was a family business which quickly flourished. And we have to remember that the ban did not affect regiments, and these were increasing in numbers. So a tartan manufacturer like the Wilsons was doing well. Now, if you were in a military situation, they would need to place large orders of tartan and cloth. So this meant that patterns had to have a standard of colour and pattern. So from the 1780s onwards, we see the start of setting down the tartans and recording them, as well as developing new designs. There's quite a lot more to it than that. It is quite involved. But MacDonald goes into a lot of detail on this, including information. He's got information on the Highland Society of London. In 1778, they wanted to establish each clan tartan. Now, this, again, is a society that's not here in Scotland, but they felt they ought to try and preserve what they thought were the original clan tartans. In fact, what was collected was not terribly old material, and MacDonald actually gives a few references to people having a bit of bother figuring out how old their tartans were. But in fact, what they actually collected together were many patterns and pieces which had been woven by Wilsons, which meant they were not really that much older than the Wilson firm, about 1765.
That's a bit wild.
Yeah.
Now, I have been paying attention in the gallery. Right. I spent a few afternoons kind of wandering around taking in, like hopefully everybody else who's been listening to this podcast. And so one of the questions I have is, what has tartan got to do with Sir Walter Scott?
Ah, you see, you're learning all the time, Dave. It's great, good. In 1822, Walter Scott, who features again in the exhibition, and various other people, including Perthshire's own Highlander, a man called Sir David Stewart of Garth, they were responsible for helping to organise George IV's state visit to Edinburgh. The first visit to Scotland by a monarch for over 200 years, so a pretty big affair. It has often been referred to as the tartan extravaganza due to the extensive use of tartan amidst all the pomp and ceremony, and it is quite amazing. Garth and Scott, you know, between them and other things, rounded up the nobles like Athol and Breadalbane and told them what they wanted to do to impress the king in Edinburgh. And all sorts of things. It was days of pageantry. I can't remember. It might have been 20 odd days of all kinds of things. When he lands, what happens, all kinds of ceremonies, all kinds of things happening. It's quite astounding. But part of this was that Walter Scott and Garth wanted men in Highland dress with all the belts and buckles and extravagance that they could supply. I've done a wee bit of research around the Murrays of Athol, because Athol was one of the men that had to bring some of these people down with them to Edinburgh, along with Breadalbane. And they were kind of, it was a bit like they'd been asked to come along, and they're kind of, then between themselves, they're thinking, well, what do we take? What do we do? How do we kit out all the men in this gear? And what do we do? And they figured out what they were going to do and bringing them all with them. Athol is actually more worried, I think, about keeping all the men sober while they're in Edinburgh. It's a lot of people to bring all, ready in their Highland dress. But they actually, he gives an account of how they met the king and all the people that are involved. Mm-hmm. And the king himself wore tartan, apparently with pieces of taffeta, silk, to cover the bits where his bareness would have been noticeable. So in all the bits when his legs and whatnot, where he would have they covered him up, because I don't suppose it was correct to see the monarch without his clothes. So even he gets dressed up and gets involved, and they complain about things. You only got 2 minutes with a king, you're all herded through and got to shake his hand and move on, sort of thing. But it's all great fun, and they really throw themselves into it, and there's that great thing. But later on, and again Athol's very big on this, but Queen Victoria's love affair with the Highlands, and of course the recent programme on Victoria show her in Blair Athol or tartan, and she gave tartan a further boost, because it became not only something practical to wear, but also a desirable fashion item, and the tartan manufacturing industry became really firmly established. So overall, that was actually that kind of romantic idea about tartan, the right thing to wear, the right stuff to have. It's ultimately good for weaving and wool and all the things that need to go into it.
And this kind of brings me on to, there's a painting in the exhibition, it's quite a nice painting of a girl in a tartan dress. That's on loan, is that correct?
That's on loan from a private collector. It's a lovely painting. I think it's become one of my favourite things, actually. Touring people around, I really point it out to them. I had some kids in this week and I said, come on, tell me what you can tell me about this girl and what they could see. She's actually a Murray of Ochter Tyre. The girl is Helen Murray, eldest daughter of Sir Patrick Murray of Ochter Tyre, and the portrait is one of very few of the period to show a female wearing tartan, and the only one that we know of really that depicts a girl. A gilt frame encloses the original portrait, but in her hand she's holding up a white rose. So we've got the tartan dress and the white rose, but the side of that painting is kind of cut off, which makes the whole picture seem a wee bit off balanced. It's just too close to her hand, and it's led to speculation that the picture had more in it. There was something else there. She was standing beside somebody, or something else was happening, or else perhaps it was damaged, and it's been reframed. So that's quite interesting, and a lot of people get that, because you can see that it looks a wee bit odd, and maybe somebody else, like her father or somebody, was standing beside her. The portrait shows the girl's costume to great effect, and actually it's a skirt and jacket, not a dress. Peter MacDonald's worked on this painting, and the tartan for both pieces is slightly different. So that's quite amazing as well, that part of the work that a historian of tartan does is to look at depictions of tartan and decide on how the pattern works, or even fragments, if sometimes those are passed down through families. If people say that they had a bit of the kilt or plaid or whatever that Bonnie Prince Charlie was wearing, you might get a scrap of it, so looking at that, and his knowledge of weaving and techniques can help people understand the actual material. It's fascinating stuff, and like I say, he has a really interesting website, Peter MacDonald, so you can actually see his research findings on various things as well, which is quite nice, and loads of other people out there looking at that kind of thing. Lots of great tartan websites, but I suppose getting to the heart of the history needs really quite thorough research.
Mm-hmm. And then we've also got this big mannequin in the gallery as well, as our Outlander guy.
Outlander guy.
And that mannequin's quite different from all the other depictions of Highland dress. So why is that then?
He's quite different, and it would seem that although legend and tradition would have us believe that a clan or family tartan has been around since the dawn of Scottish history, it's now clear that the development of tartan in its current form dates very much from this family business, Wilson's, and then through the Victorian times. And this development's still continuing today. You can still create a tartan, you can still register and, you bring something new. And I think that's what's brilliant, that all this research and interest carries on. People have gotten really involved in what we see, because reenactors, they're all trying to get the details correct. So that keeps that debate going. Historians focusing on the research and understanding this aspect of material culture, or whether it's someone looking at the fabric and colours and thinking about what an old piece of textile can tell us. So our Jacobite Clans exhibition is speaking to all of these people, and the online comments we have, the feedback, people contacting as well, you know, if they want to ask us about something or give us some more information, put us straight, you've got that bit wrong, what's that about, or I think this should be, or, you know, so hopefully we're all learning something new along the way, which is great.
Yeah, and I think from a personal point of view, I think something like Outlander, it puts very much like the stories and the history of Claude and like very much at the forefront, but it does encourage people to find out the real story, the real history, and not take it for fact as well. You know, that's something I think is really good. So Nicola, I think we'll just wind up there. So for those who are listening, Jacobite Clans is on until October 26th. We've only got a few weeks left to go. You can find out everything about Perth Museum and Art Gallery and all the work that Culture Perth and Kinross does on our website. That's www.culturepk.org.uk. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. These reviews really count. And hopefully you'll join us next week. Thank you very much.